The headlines: Iran and Venezuela forging their strategic bonds with a 20-year cooperation deal as President Maduro visits Tehran. In Bolivia, former President Jeanine Añez is facing 10 years in jail for her role in a plot to oust her predecessor, Evo Morales. Plus, Ukraine's military says it urgently needs Western weaponry to ward off Russian attacks in the east. And welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. Iran and Venezuela have pledged to forge closer cooperation on all fronts to further strengthen bilateral relations. To that aim, the presidents of the two countries have signed a 20-year cooperation deal. They have also hailed their nation's resistance against foreign pressure.
Venezuela has shown that it has put up exemplary resistance against the enemy's threats, sanctions, and imperialism. The Iranian nation, too, has been under numerous sanctions and threats for more than 40 years now. But the Iranian people have turned these sanctions into an opportunity to further make progress.
President Raisi and his Venezuelan counterpart said that the two countries should work together to closely in areas such as trade, economy, agriculture, as well as science and technology. They also hailed the establishment of direct Tehran-Caracas flights as an opportunity to enhance relations and bring the two nations closer together. The Venezuelan president arrived in Tehran on Friday for a two-day official visit. Political analyst Said Mustafa Hoshchishm explains how the close cooperation between Venezuela and Iran is helping them overcome their problems.
Iran rushed to Maduro's help and the Venezuelan people's help. The people were queuing lines, waiting to fill their car tanks. And Iran sent a dozen tankers, not only taking petrol to Venezuela, but also spare parts for refineries, engineers, technology, and everything, as well as additives and, to help the country come back online, bring their refineries back online. And that soothed, actually, the crisis in the country and defused the U.S. plans for overthrowing the government in there. So the two are also major oil-producing countries and could help each other with managing the global oil market as we are approaching winter, and then the energy prices are rising because of the Ukraine war, and the U.S. needs much energy imports as well as the Europeans, and they need energy, and the only two countries that might increase supplies in the market and have reserves are Venezuela and Iran, so they could play a major role in coming months with regard to energy market.
For the second day in a row, the members of the anti-Iran terrorist group Mujahideen Khalq organization have tried to sabotage an exhibition in the Swedish capital displaying their crimes. Bianca Rahimi reports.
Members of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist group, also known as the MKO, gathered in the Swedish capital on Friday for the second day in a row to sabotage an exhibition on the group's crimes. The Swedish police struggled to control the situation, with MKO members spreading out, running down the streets away from the place designated for the protest and harassing Press TV's reporters and camera crew. On Thursday, several members of the MKO were arrested for attacking the exhibition and throwing objects, including paint, at the exhibition and public property. The organizer of the expo, the Harbilion NGO, say the police tried to sabotage the event by refusing to allow banners to be put up and denying journalists adequate security, despite them having the necessary permits. The MKO has conducted numerous assassinations and bombings against Iranian statesmen and civilians since the 1979 victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Its members fled Iran in 1986 to Iraq, where they enjoyed backing from former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. MKO terrorists enjoy freedom of activity and movement in the US and Europe, and even hold regular meetings in which European and American officials make speeches.
The organizers of this event say that the MKO has protested in the Swedish capital for 90 days straight with government security. This suggests that this organization feels safe and protected here in Sweden. Bianca Rahimi, Stockholm.
Former Bolivian President Jeanine Anez has been sentenced to jail for orchestrating a coup that brought her to power during the 2019 political crisis. The court has ruled that the 54-year-old will serve 10 years in a woman's prison in La Paz. This comes more than a year after she was arrested for an alleged plot to oust her predecessor, Evo Morales. Anez was convicted of making decisions contrary to the Bolivian constitution. She had already announced that she would appeal to international legal bodies if convicted. But Anez still faces a separate pending court case for sedition and other charges. The former army and police heads are also facing 10 years jail terms each, but both are currently on the run. Members of Iraq's Sadr movement have resigned from parliament as the country fails to form a new government nearly 8 months after the elections. The Sadr movement secured 73 seats in the October parliamentary elections. That was the greatest number of seats won by a party, but it fell short of 165-seat majority needed to form the government. The Sadr movement has formed an alliance with the Kurdistan Democratic Party and other parties to form a coalition, but the movement has failed to find common ground with its rival coordination framework. Meanwhile, Ukraine is asking the West for more weapons as Russia steps up attacks in the east more than 3 months into the war there. Ukrainian military officials say they are outgunned by the more powerful Russian army. They say they need more advanced Western weapons, including rocket systems, to fend off Russian artillery attacks. Moscow has been focusing its firepower in the eastern Donbass region over the past few weeks, with the fiercest battles taking place in Severodonetsk, an industrial city in Luhansk province. Ukrainians have largely pulled out of the city's residential areas, but they are still putting up resistance against Russian advance from the north and the south. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Russia is trying to break every town in Donbass. Staying with Ukraine, the country is also calling for more humanitarian aid as the health situation worsens in the city of Mariupol. Major port city into Russian hands in May. According to officials there, dead bodies and rubbish remain uncollected in the streets. That adds to a poor sanitation system broken by weeks of fighting, causing water to mix with sewage. Now Mariupol's mayor says they have identified cases of dysentery, cholera, and other infectious diseases. The city has been closed off to avoid a larger outbreak that could take thousands of lives. The United Nations has also warned that Mariupol is at risk of a major cholera outbreak. The fallout of the Russia-Ukraine war continues to take a heavy toll on U.S. economy. U.S. stocks fell sharply as the country's inflation surges to a new four-decade high record. The New York Stock Exchange saw Dow Jones Industrial Average, the broad-based S&P 500, and the tech-rich NASDAQ Composite Index all tumble. It came after the Labor Department said the Consumer Price Index surged by 8.6% in May compared to the same period last year. Now, this is unseen since 1981. The figure exceeds all forecasts, and it comes as gasoline prices are hitting records every single day in the U.S. as the war in Ukraine drags on. Prices also continued to rise last month for a range of other goods, including housing, groceries, airline fares, and vehicles. The U.S. and China ramp up a war of words over Taiwan, a self-ruled island that China considers as part of its territory. The Pentagon chief has accused the Chinese military of provocative, destabilizing activities near Taiwan. Lloyd Austin has told a security summit in Singapore that there is growing coercion from Beijing. On Friday, Chinese Defense Minister Wei Fenghe says that his country did not hesitate and would not hesitate a war if Taiwan declares independence. The same day, the two officials met on the sidelines of the summit to discuss global, regional, and bilateral security issues. Their talks largely focus on Taiwan. Beijing is opposed to Washington's growing military and diplomatic ties with the country. Recently, President Joe Biden also angered China after he vowed to defend Taiwan militarily if attacked. People across Iran are marking the birth anniversary of Imam Reza, the eighth Shia imam. Thousands of Iranians and foreign pilgrims are also in the city of Mashhad to pay respect to the imam. In the northeastern city, the holy shrine of Imam Reza, who is considered a symbol of divine love and affection, ceremonies include special prayers, poetry reading, and other performances. Also, there was a ceremony that was held by the Scientific and Cultural Organization of Imam Reza's Holy Shrine. This year's events send a strong message to Islamophobes around the world, with Muslims pledging not to remain silent on the insults against their beliefs and sacred religious figures.
Thousands of Iranian Muslims have come together in capital Tehran to celebrate the birth anniversary of Imam Reza, the eighth infallible Shia imam. People from different walks of life took part in the ceremony to pay respect to the lofty status of Imam Reza, who is considered by Iranians as a symbol of divine love and affection.
I'm here to say that we love Imam Reza from the bottom of our hearts. I have raised my children with a love for Imam Reza. We are ready to die for him, and we will continue his path.
The ceremony comes almost 10 days after France awarded a movie titled Holy Spider during the Cannes Film Festival, which Muslims believed insulted Islamic sanctities.
Iranian officials believe that awarding the movie Holy Spider is insulting and politically motivated and is the product of the confused mind of a Danish-Iranian filmmaker, sponsored and financed by Global Arms.
People strongly condemn the move by France, saying such a sacrilegious act will never be forgotten.
I want to send this message to the enemies that the light of the sun will never fade away, so the name and the path of Imam Reza will remain forever and the enemies' plots will never bear any results.
The participants believe that the large gathering of Muslim believers has sent this message to the enemies of Islam, that Muslims will never remain silent and indifferent towards any insult against their sanctities, and they are ready to defend their Islamic values and beliefs until the last drop of their blood. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Indian-controlled Kashmir shuts businesses and shops to denounce blasphemous remarks of two Indian politicians against Prophet Muhammad. Shana Butt reports.
In the Muslim-majority Indian-administered Kashmir, people observed a shutdown to denounce the derogatory remarks by two members of the ruling Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party against Prophet Muhammad. After condemnations by the global Muslim community, the two were suspended. Despite strict security arrangements, people in the summer capital, Srinagar, took to the streets saying they have tolerated everything so far, but nothing against their beloved prophet.
We demand stringent punishment against these culprits. No religion teaches intolerance. What we see growing attacks on Muslims and their emotions in India now.
These two people have dented the image of Hinduism on the global forum by speaking against the prophet of Islam. Scores of Muslim countries are today upset about India and its behavior towards minority Muslims. We have tolerated a lot, be it scraping of Article 370 or delimitation, but this time it's about our beloved prophet. We'll take to the streets without fearing any consequences.
In Srinagar, mobile internet services were suspended as a precautionary measure to avoid the snowballing of protests. Government forces were seen deployed in strength while people closed down businesses, shops and other activities. Last week, BJP suspended its national spokesperson, Nupur Sharma, who made anti-Islam remarks on a TV debate last month. Also, Naveen Kumar Jindal was expelled from the party over his blasphemous tweets about the Prophet Muhammad. The controversial remarks against the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, have sparked global outrage against India. The Muslim community across the world is denouncing the growing anti-Muslim ideology and hate crimes against the minorities in the country. They're accusing BJP of backing anti-Muslim ideology in what they call once a secular India. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
A mix of Shia, Sunni and Sufi scholars have gathered in the English city of Birmingham to condemn the release of a divisive film, The Lady of Heaven, produced by a notorious hate preacher. The move is intended to counter sectarianism and educate against misleading mainstream media narratives surrounding the film. Robert Carter reports.
Amid nationwide Muslim protests against the controversial Lady of Heaven movie, British scholars gathered in Birmingham to condemn the hateful message. Representatives from the Shia, Sunni and Sufi Islamic schools of thought signed a joint statement, slamming the film as divisive and sectarian.
The recently released film, The Lady of Heaven, has incited sectarian tension amongst Muslims for its offensive depiction of early Muslim history. We strongly and without reservation condemn its writer Yasir al-Habib for this contemptible action.
Released in British theatres on June the 3rd, the film attempts to depict the life and death of Fatima Zahra, the daughter of beloved Islamic prophet Muhammad. However, offensive depictions of the prophet's wife and companions sparked protests. Following the backlash, British media adopted the narrative of the movie's writer, notorious hate preacher Yasser Habib, portraying the protests as a Sunni-Shia conflict. What the media totally missed, however, is the significant Shia Muslim opposition.
I need to be able to put your feelings even ahead of mine. I need to prefer you to my own self and understand that the words that I use and the historical underpinnings that I have may offend you. And thus, I need to be able to put your peace of mind, peace of heart, even ahead of myself.
After spending the day here, it's become absolutely clear to us that the divisive and sectarian narrative that's been adopted by the British mainstream media is totally false. However, the question is, will the British mainstream adopt these types of events in their coverage, or will they continue to peddle the divisive narrative that's being put out there by the producers of this sectarian film? Robert Carter, Birmingham.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei elaborates on six key points of Imam Khomeini's testament. June 4, 2018. Let me refer to some of the points mentioned in Imam Khomeini's testament, which is full of useful meaning. The first point is that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi insisted in his testament on the fact that the Islamic revolution is a divine revolution, and it is mainly based on the will of the people. The Islamic revolution belongs to the people. This means that no individual, social class or group can and should claim to be the owner of this revolution and consider others as a subsidiary. If anyone was to claim to the owner of this revolution, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi was the most suitable person who was deserving of ownership. This revolution was due to his determination and personality, but Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh considers his own role as very little and considers the revolution as a blessing from God. This is a predominant theme in Imam Khomeini's statements, which has also been stressed and specified in his testament. Therefore, it is the people who are the owners of this revolution. Protecting this divine gift is a duty that lies upon everyone's shoulders.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The people must consider themselves as the guardians of the revolution. The identity and significance of the revolution are due to its principles, orientations, and values. There have always been, and there will always be, some individuals who have tried to change the revolutionary ideas under the pretext that the conditions have changed. They have tried to separate the aspects related to religion and social justice from the revolution. They have tried to make the revolution devoid of its tendency to fight outsiders, hegemony, and autocracy. They may step into the ring with various motives and under various pretexts to change the revolutionary slogans and aspirations. The people have to be alert. They must know that this revolution is alive due to its values. Being Islamic, adhering to religious principles, opposing hegemony and arrogance, and supporting the oppressed sincerely and openly all over the world are the most essential values among the slogans written on the revolutionary flag.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
A former head of Israeli regime's Mossad spy agency was deported from the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2019 after it emerged that he was involved in a plot to overthrow the country's president. During his visit to the DRC, the top Mossad spy was accompanied by Israeli oligarch Dan Gertler, who is involved in looting Congo's mineral resources, such as cobalt, while indigenous people are languishing in poverty. A Congolese professor elaborates here on how plundering by capitalists such as Gertler has destroyed the country. Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. This week, we are focusing on Israeli regime's destabilization activities in Africa. The Tel Aviv regime dispatched its top spy to the Democratic Republic of Congo to plan a coup against a democratically elected government. So why is the Tel Aviv regime meddling in the DRC? This is one of the questions our expert will be answering. The second part of our program will be on some of the challenges Africa faces in improving energy access as it seeks to industrialize. So stay with us as our experts give us their incisive analysis.
Mossad meddling in the DRC. The former chief of Israel's Mossad spy agency, Yossi Cohen, was humiliated after he was deported from the Democratic Republic in 2019. According to media reports, his ejection from Kinshasa came after the country's president obtained classified reports that the Mossad chief was planning a coup against him. The expose on the Israeli regime's plot to overthrow DRC's government comes when the regime has been lobbying to be an observer member of the African Union.
Leading Pan-Africanist Pierre Lumumba in voicing his opposition to the Israeli regime's observer status at the AU said the Tel Aviv regime might be pursuing hidden objectives in its attempt to infiltrate Africa.
I find no merit in Israel enjoying observer status at the African Union. And thirdly, I am puzzled why that is important at all. I do not see any value at all that is added by Israel enjoying observer status at the AU, unless there are certain subterranean political interests which are at play in this particular matter.
Well, for more on the Israeli regime's meddling in the Democratic Republic of Congo, we have contacted Kambale Musavuli, a human rights activist and an analyst at the Center for Research on the Congo. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now, can you give us a brief account on what led to the humiliating expulsion of the Mossad spy agency chief in the Democratic Republic of Congo?
We know that Congo, the Congolese president, became very close to Israel. I believe that he felt that by becoming close to Israel, that would give him some cover to rule the Congo and control the country. But it was a surprise to him that while he was close to Israel, there was something else happening. The first visit is unclear of when it took place. The second visit, we know, took place on October 9th of 2019. Right when the president of the Congo was traveling to the eastern part of the country. And it's very important to look at that context. The head of Mossad came into the DRC when the president of the Congo was traveling to the east, and at the same time, the same day he was traveling to the east, one of the planes with Congolese soldiers and some of his vehicles, the bulletproof vehicles and so on, got into an accident, right? There was a plane crash of the presidential convoy. So that raised a lot of suspicion about why the Mossad head was in DRC unannounced twice already without the country knowing why he was coming there.
During his visit to Kinshasa, the Mossad chief was in the company of Gertler, one of former President Joseph Kabila's closest business cronies. This corrupt Zionist wheeler dealer is said to have bribed Congolese authorities to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars in exchange for mining rights in the DRC. Gertler recently signed a deal with the current government in Kinshasa that would allow the DRC to recover looted mining and oil assets of Gertler's company Ventura, worth more than $2 billion. That's a colossal amount of money looted from a country with some of the poorest people on earth. Is Mossad involved in the looting of DRC's wealth?
The New York Times had an expose that explained who Doug Gertler was. Cohen traveling to DRC with Dan Gertler may be a shock to people. But we in the DRC, especially at the Center for Research of the Congo, we have studied for quite some time Dan Gertler's dealing in the DRC. We're not that surprised. He's a very powerful businessman in the DRC. He's made billions of dollars on shady deals in the DRC. And in the New York Times expose that I'm referencing, it was clearly stated that he is an intelligence asset for Mossad and serves for U.S. national interests in Central Africa.
The Israeli regime has close ties with the former and current DRC president, and this has raised questions on what Cohen was really pursuing in Kinshasa. Now, is it possible that different Israeli regime factions are competing for the control of the DRC, especially since the current president, Felix Tshisekedi, who was reportedly almost deposed by Mossad also enjoys close ties with the Israeli regime.
The engagement of Felix to Israel has been to continue the policies of his predecessors, of using Israel as the space or the country for access for intelligence tools. Some of the Israeli companies have been engaged in the Congo. The NSO that pretty much manufactured or created the Pegasus virus. NSO is still operating in the DRC. There is no indication that they have stopped under the Tshisekedi regime. We know there are other Israeli interests there. But the most important under the Felix regime, the most important engagement is that under his regime and under his the Congo being the chairman of the African Union, the DRC played a central role with the chairperson of the AU Commission to recognize Israel as a member state of the African Union. So that's why Israel needed the DRC.
The Israeli regime had close military links with the apartheid regime in South Africa and Rwanda during the 1994 genocide. The regime has also been selling weapons, fueling civil wars in several African countries. Now, the Israeli regime is literally plundering the resources of the Democratic Republic of Congo, widely considered to be the richest country in the world in terms of natural resources. Considering the foregoing, can we say that the African Union should categorically reject the Israeli regime's attempt to become an observer member?
I mean, the decision for Israel to become an observatory member of the African Union did not come from the African people. Now, African people have always been on the side of the Palestinian people. The African Union has put a statement denouncing the apartheid that the Palestinian people live in, that's imposed on them by Israel. So we, the African people, are very clear about what the Palestinian people are living. What took place was an undemocratic process of electing or pretty much imposing on the African people the status of Israel within the African Union.
It is quite interesting that the Israeli regime sought to oust DRC's president and at the same time used him in its attempt to gain observer status at the African Union. Now, very briefly as we wind up, should this be a warning bell to African leaders that they cannot trust the Tel Aviv regime?
Those leaders on the African continent who are supporting Israel, behind their backs, Israel is plotting a coup in the case of the Congo. While the Congolese president is supporting Israel, the head of intelligence of Israel, Cohen, allegedly was plotting a coup in DRC. That's a signal for those leaders who are supporting Israel that they may even turn against you. So they should be on the side of the African people, of supporting the people of Palestine, demanding that the Palestinians can return on their land, control their own affairs, and live peacefully and freely in the land like any human being should live.
Well, we'd like to thank Mr. Kambale Musavoli of the Center for Research on the Congo for his incisive analysis. Now we now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall be talking about the status of the access to electricity in Africa. Stay with us.
Lighting up Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
electricity access is one of the biggest developmental challenges facing many African countries. Millions of people across the continent live in complete darkness, unable to access electricity for basic household use such as lighting, charging phones and laptops.
In their recent book titled The Challenge of Energy Access in Africa, authors Manfred Hafner, Simone Talia Pietra and Lucia de Strasser identified four major problems militating against energy access on the continent. Decades of neglect in building up countrywide infrastructure, a lack of international investment, poor regulatory frameworks, and difficulty surrounding bankability of power projects.
According to the Africa Development Bank, over 640 million Africans have no access to energy, corresponding to an electricity access rate for African countries at just over 40%, the lowest in the world. Now, the president of the Africa Development Bank Group, Akinwumi Adesina, says lack of electricity is killing industries in Nigeria, Africa's largest economy.
Listen, ladies and gentlemen, a lack of electricity is killing Nigerian industries. Something Chief Odutola was concerned about way back in 1971. According to the Manufacturers Association of Nigeria, industries spend $93.1 billion, a billion naira, I must say, on alternative energy in 2018. That is 47 years after Chief Odutola. Today, no business can survive in Nigeria without generators. Consequently, the abnormal has become normal.
Well, for more on the state of electricity supply in Africa, we contacted Lawrence Freeman, a political economic analyst for Africa. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Okay.
Now, why is access to electricity the biggest development challenge facing many African countries, yet the continent is home to vast energy resources?
The problem is that the African nations have never been able to build up the infrastructure, of which energy is the most important feature, for their economies. Don't forget, since the emergence of the African nations in the 1960s, there has been, from the West, a refusal to help these nations actually develop by making investments in infrastructure, by making investments in energy. All kinds of aid has been delivered, and all kinds of speeches have been made. And the lack of energy in Africa is literally killing Africans. Not figuratively, but literally, because you can't have an industrialized economy without energy. And if you don't have an industrialized economy, people live in poverty and die.
South Africa, Africa's second largest economy, has the highest energy consumption on the continent. Yet unscheduled power outages are on the increase. The country's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, last year announced another project to deal with the country's energy crisis.
Through this Hydrogen South Africa strategy, government and its partners have successfully deployed hydrogen fuel cells to provide electricity in some of our schools and to build hospitals established as part of the country's COVID-19 response.
North Africa seems to be relatively well off compared to sub-Saharan Africa in terms of access to electricity. What is the situation in African countries such as Nigeria and South Africa?
Across sub-Saharan Africa, not counting the Maghreb, in sub-Saharan Africa, the lack of energy is pervasive and deadly. And there's no country. Look, there's only 100 to 110,000 megawatts of power capacity for over a billion people in sub-Saharan Africa. 40,000 is produced in South Africa, but South Africa doesn't have enough energy. And you have other countries like Nigeria, which are living on less than 100 watts of electricity per capita. So there is no good news story. There's no country who's delivering energy. and not even close to the energy that's needed. My estimates are we need 1,000 gigawatts of electricity, and all we have is 100,000 megawatts. So the deficit is striking.
Ethiopia's Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is said to be the largest hydroelectric scheme in Africa, but has been at the center of regional dispute. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed officially inaugurated electricity production from the country's mega dam on the Blue Nile in February.
Now, Mr. Freeman, what impact will the Ethiopia dam have on efforts to ensure greater access to electricity in African countries?
The most significant development is Ethiopia has a Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, GERD, and they embarked on this about 10 years ago. And within the next month or two, they will be involved in the third filling of this dam. This will be the largest dam on the continent of Africa. It will have a reservoir of about 74 billion cubic meters, estimated to generate over 6,000 megawatts. Now, this will be a significant increase for Ethiopia, and they will also export energy to the region, Kenya, South Sudan, maybe Tanzania. But it's still not enough, but it's a big development.
Now, although many in other continents are moving towards nuclear energy, South Africa remains the only African country that generates nuclear energy. Other countries such as Nigeria, Egypt, and Kenya have plans to set up nuclear power plants. Now, do you think nuclear energy can be an option for Africa?
You have about 16 or 17 African countries in various phases of acquiring nuclear energy, which would be the best for Africa, and it's the best form of energy. Egypt, I think, is working with Russia to build several nuclear energy plants. South Africa is embarking on a plan to build possibly four nuclear power plants. And many other countries, Ghana, Nigeria, and others, are in the process of acquiring permits and feasibility studies. This would be a huge increase for Africa to start deploying nuclear energy.
A recent report by Wood Mackenzie Limited says sub-Saharan African countries will need to invest as much as $350 billion between now and 2030 to be able to considerably improve electricity and generation distribution. Now, is this objective achievable in your opinion?
What I've been working on with my African friends is to establish an Africa Infrastructure Development Bank, which would be a bank that would lend out money, credit, for infrastructure, of which energy would be the primary, along with high-speed railroads, would be the most important investments for this infrastructure bank. And the West just turns away a blind eye to the actual needs of Africa in energy. And without energy, you won't solve the food crisis. Without energy, you won't end hunger. Without energy, you won't end poverty. And yet, the Western institutions do nothing but complain and feel bad, but they won't make the investment necessary. Russia and China and India will probably do more in providing nuclear energy for Africa than the West.
According to some reports, over 30% of electricity in France generated by uranium for Niger, yet only 1 in 7 Nigerians have access to modern electricity services. Can we say that the exploitation by former colonial powers such as France is a major factor in lack of electricity in Africa?
And it's true, the French never developed their 14 countries that are part of Francophone arrangements. And they basically are carrying out the colonial policy of taking the resource of uranium to develop their own energy base, nuclear base, and doing nothing to help Niger.
renewable energy's potential across the African continent remains largely untapped. Now, the president of the Africa Development Bank says the bank is funding renewable energy projects in the continent. Let's take a listen.
Africa has abundant energy resources, including solar, hydro, geothermal, and also wind. The African Development Bank is spearheading investments in renewable energy. And guess what? 85% of all the African Development Bank's investment in energy is in renewable energy.
Now, my last question to Mr. Freeman, what is preventing the wider use of renewable energy sources such as solar, which is readily available across Africa?
Well, it is, and the problem you have is you have a whole colonial mindset which dominates the West. There's a totally different thinking coming from China in particular. The West, in their colonial mindset, have never intended to develop Africa. We have an anti-development mindset, which corresponds in some ways to a colonial mindset. And this continent with all these resources has never been developed, and that's by intention. And that is very sad, and that's what I'm trying to change with my work and my website and my writings and my lectures.
Well, there you have it. Western neocolonial powers led by the United States prefer an underdeveloped Africa so that they can continue looting the continent's resources. That's the opinion of Lawrence Freeman, an expert on African affairs. We'd like to thank him for his insight on the subject. Well, and that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Send us your comments through our social media handle. Take care and goodbye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Welcome to IRB English Radio. This is Asma, your humble host for today's episode. And you're hearing me from Q&A on Islamic Belief, in which we shall discuss some very controversial issues. Well, without further ado, I would like to go directly into the main of discussion. But before that, I would like to introduce my guest. Welcome, brother.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I'm so happy to meet you here again.
My pleasure.
So here with us, we have Dr. Karimi. And in this episode, we're going to discuss some debatable questions. So stay tuned. Well, today's question is related to love and marriage, which asks, love has to happen after marriage or not? Does it have to happen only after marriage, or is it possible for love to happen before marriage? Is it acceptable?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So basically the question somehow is against the concept of, some of the Islamic laws. According to Islamic laws, we do not believe in the boyfriend-girlfriend relations before them being mahram to each other. And after reciting the contract of marriage, they are mahram to each other. So They say that this is against the concept of love.
And just to explain for the audience The concept of mahram, shall you please give us a brief explanation?
Yeah, according to the religion of Islam, mahram is referring, when it comes to a man and woman, the mahram women are the ladies who do not need to cover themselves in front of that man. So it includes, for example, his mother, his daughters, his sisters, his aunts, and some other
those
people.
Those who have a blood relation or they have been married to them.
Yeah. Of course, not all the people through blood relations.
Yes, yes.
We have all these details mentioned in the books of jurisprudence. Now, the question says that, okay, according to the religion of Islam, you say that boys and girls cannot have any kind of relation to each other. So they need to get married and then they can be mahram to each other and have relation, which means that before they love each other, they need to get married. But there is no guarantee that when they get married, they would love each other. So somehow this Islamic law is against the concept of love, if we may put it this way.
Yes.
Now, the first point is that, is there a guarantee that those people who loved each other and then they got married, they will be
continue loving each other after marriage
or not? Is there any guarantee? Because these people are looking for a guarantee for love after marriage.
But of course, nothing in life has guarantee.
Nothing has guarantee. So the first point is that not all the people, we are not against the concept of love. We have so many narrations about the concept of love in our books of narrations and the ways that the wife and husband needs to express their love toward each other, toward their children, and so on and so forth. But my point is that there is no guarantee that those people who love, as boyfriend and girlfriend, they love each other and then they get married, but they remained as loving each other after marriage. There is no guarantee. And I think statistics tell us that in many cases also they ended up in divorce as well.
Exactly.
Even people who loved each other before getting married. So it's not a way to undermine the Islamic laws to just say that there is no guarantee. There is no guarantee even for BFGF, relations as well after marriage. The second question is that if we may think of two options, a marriage based on cognition and knowledge and a marriage based on love, which one is preferred? According to the religion of Islam, first and foremost, marriage should be based on understanding and
logic
and recognizing each other Of course, love matters, but before that, what matters the most is to know each other.
The person himself or herself.
But unfortunately, what matters in boyfriend and girlfriend relations is that they love each other and they do not see the faults and the deficiencies. And that is what, when they get married, they live together. Just then they come to know the realities of each other.
They don't look beyond the person who they are seeing right now.
That's the point. So Islam says that before getting married, go to know each other. And there are many ways. Islam is not, promoting the idea of getting married with
blind eyes
and with a boy and a girl that do not know anything about that. No,
they have
not
no
at
idea
all.
About each other.
Yeah, in the past we have some so-called traditional families who may have done so. But this is not the Islamic way
exactly.
of getting married.
Exactly, it was tradition. It wasn't about the religion.
It was a tradition, and maybe some people thought that this is Islamic, but this is not Islamic. Mm-hmm. This is anti-Islamic. So before marriage, you need to know each other. But does it necessarily mean that this knowledge should be through boyfriend-girlfriend relation? Islam says that no, you can know each other through some ways. One way can be, for example, talking to each other, but the families know about.
They are all aware of what's going on.
They all are aware of that. So when it is done under the control of the families, it means that
no one would get hurt.
Exactly. And all these bad stories that we hear, none of them will happen. So through these dialogue sessions, if you may call it dialogue sessions, boys and girls, they come to know each other. Without touching, of course, they are non-mahram to each other.
They would get the headlines about each
exactly.
other.
Exactly. And they will come to this understanding whether they can match each other or not. And through that, love may happen too. So if they come to this understanding that they match each other, love can happen before marriage too. Mm-hmm.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So my point is that Islam emphasizes on knowing each other before marriage and not on
just love,
which according to these people requires relation, without being mahram to each other. Islam is against that. Islam is against such relations which are done without the father.